Breaking ball and a call. Strike three. Third strikeout for Zach.
He's going to just watch it go. A grand slam for Bryson Stott.
And there's a high fly ball. Deep right field. Harper watches it fly.
From WHYY and Billy Penn, this is your Friday edition of Hittin' Season, a Philadelphia Phillies podcast. My name is Justin Clue. I write for Baseball Prospectus, and with me is Liz Rocher of Yahoo Sports. Hello, Liz.
Hello, Justin.
Going into the weekend, Phillies are flying out west, coming off a four-game stretch in Cincinnati. The first, what was definitely being viewed as a real-er test than the teams the Phillies had been playing. And in game one, they looked up to the task of playing a better-than-terrible baseball team. Second game, not so much. Third game, even more not so much. And then managed to shut the Reds out again in game four with a great Zach Wheeler start. We also had, in the minor leagues, Gabriel Rincones Jr., Phillies prospect, absolutely demolished baseball out of First Energy Stadium. We're going to talk to Mitch Rupert, formerly of the Williamsport Sun-Gazette, right after in a little bit. But first, Liz, this series in Cincinnati, do you feel like you learned anything new about the 2024 Phillies during these four games against the Reds?
I feel very strongly that right now they are a no middle ground team. I feel like it's good or bad for most of the time. They're either hitting a bunch of home runs or no one is hitting home runs, but the pitching's great.
Yeah, it's interesting. The offense being such an issue for this team, we're going to hear some numbers up ahead that indicate, you know, they may not be the most sluggish offense in baseball, at least not forever, which is always tough to believe when a team gets off to the kind of start the Phillies got off to. But again, this is one of the hottest. This is the hottest start the team has gotten off to since 2019. And splitting the series with the Reds means that they have still won 8 of their last 10, no matter how infuriating the two losses in the middle of this four-game set with the Reds made you feel. The Phillies used some small ball and a three-run shot by Cody Clemens, who was then demoted yesterday after Bryce Harper returned from paternity leave.
Thanks, Cody.
Seriously, thank you. To score 7 runs in game one, and they used Ranger Suarez's 7 shutout innings to beat the Reds 7-0, increasing Suarez's scoreless streak to 25 innings. Liz, what is more impressive to you, 25 straight scoreless innings by Ranger Suarez or Trey Turner having a stolen base streak that lasts 41 games before it ends?
That's a really good question.
Sorry, not 41 games. 41 straight successful stolen bases.
Yes, attempts. I would say it's Ranger Suarez, because if only because we don't necessarily expect that type of stretch of dominance from him. Though, I mean, in the future, maybe we will.
I mean, the odds alone kind of indicate you're not going to be able to steal 41 bases successfully. But
oh, sure. Like, I'm not saying that's not impressive. It is very impressive.
Yeah, it's just it's something that, like, you're facing in that stretch guys who are obviously not good at throwing out runners at second base, catchers who are not necessarily what you call snipers. Not every team has a catcher who is extremely good at throwing out base runners. Martin Maldonado of the White Sox comes to mind, whom the Phillies just played against for a couple of games. But at the same time, 41 attempts means you are obviously picking your spots and being strategic, but also means you can run on guys that other base runners can't run on. You just have the kind of speed and base running IQ to get away with that, which, again, sometimes it feels incredible we're saying that about a Phillies base runner. this series, again, you saw guys overrunning bases or getting caught between bases, and Turner was one of those guys on a play that was supposed to work. The Phillies had, Matt Gelb told us, tried in the postseason. But, yeah, I guess in general, the fact that he was able to do that for so long against so many different catchers in so many different situations and do so successfully, like with a 100% success rate, was crazy. Whereas Suarez's scoreless streak is dominant, and I think it definitely raises the bar as to what you can expect from Ranger Suarez moving forward. But at the same time, it's so good at this point, all anyone's talking about is the inevitable end to it. Like, it is clearly game for regression, I suppose.
Yeah, him and Spencer Turnbull, I think we're all, Turnbull's going to the bullpen, which I think is going to keep him fresh a lot longer. But if he kept on going in the rotation, I had a strong suspicion he was going to get absolutely blown up one day. And I know that's coming for Ranger. Something is coming. Maybe not. Hopefully not that, but something's coming.
In either case, both are huge milestones and statistical accomplishments by two Phillies players that have certainly contributed to this team's success so far this season. In game two, Christopher Sanchez, like you said, couldn't contain the Reds' Christian and Encarnacion Strand. The Reds' first baseman had a three-hit day against Sanchez. Alec Boehm had a big goof at first in a key moment. That was one of the Phillies' three errors in game two, as Rob Thompson went with that righty-heavy lineup that I think in game two we were a little wary of. But then by game three, when we saw it again, people were downright impatient based on what happened in game two, which was an 8-1 loss. Liz, were you surprised to see another, you know, that same righty heavy, which means bench emptying lineup by Rob Thompson for a second game in a row in this series after they got pounded 8-1 in the first time they tried it?
I found it frustrating. I found it frustrating to see it again because that was a frustrating game to watch. I the results were slightly different the second day, though not. The outcome was the same. The results were different, but the outcome was the same. That doesn't necessarily make sense.
Well, I think in game three, the lineup was one of a cornucopia of issues you could criticize Rob Thompson for. So it kind of just got thrown on the pile with the rest of the stuff. So going into game three, the Phillies had obviously won a game and lost a game, and everybody was looking for them to, you know, not turn this into a mess of any kind or a downward spiral or proof that they couldn't beat better than terrible teams. But seeing that lineup, I think, set the tone for the day. People were, you know, they'd been wary the day before. They were kind of angry seeing it because it meant Christian Pache in the lineup over Brandon Marsh. It meant Whit Merrifield in the lineup over Bryson Stott. And it meant Edmundo Sosa in the lineup, but he wasn't replacing anyone directly.
He was just there.
Alec Boehm was being moved over to first because in addition to Rob Thompson's lineup decisions, Bryce Harper was also on paternity leave. So Alec Boehm was playing first and never looked super comfortable there just defensively, but that also meant Edmundo Sosa had to play third. So it did kind of look like a hangover lineup, especially when you throw Garrett Stubbs in there, but he was only there because he's done all the catching for Spencer Turnbull in Spencer Turnbull's starts so far. So really, the bottom half of the order was not necessarily the Phillies' best overall hitters, but I feel like you got to say, if you're going to criticize this lineup, it's worth pointing out they're going up against a tough young lefty, Nick Lodolo of Cincinnati. Liz, Christian Pache, since the beginning of 2023, has hit .314 in 57 plate appearances against left-handed pitching.
Mm-hmm.
Brandon Marsh has hit .229 in that same stretch.
Mm-hmm.
We all agree Brandon Marsh is a better overall player than Christian Pache, but this decision wasn't made for no reason. It's not like Rob Thompson was just like, my gut says. No, he was looking at the numbers and he said, look, I mean, there's a big gap here as far as success against lefties, and I'm trying to give this team an edge. I don't think you can make as strong an argument for Whit Merrifield, who in that stretch has hit .259 versus lefties with three home runs and 157 plate appearances. Edmundo Sosa, .267 and 124 plate appearances facing lefties, though this year he is 5-13 against them with a double and a home run. Stott versus lefties, .282 from the beginning of 2023 to now, 5-17 against lefties in 2024. So in that case, it does feel more like Rob Thompson going with a more old school approach. If we're facing a lefty, let's throw some righties at him. In Pache's case, the numbers, I think, are there. They kind of support that decision. But I think in general, people are just frustrated about not seeing Brandon Marsh get a lot of starts. Numbers, you know, who cares? Even with this information in front of you, Liz, does this soften any kind of criticisms about the lineup for you going into game three?
It does soften it a little bit. I had looked at some splits, but I'll admit I had not actually looked at Brandon Marsh's split specifically. So, you know, that does make me feel a little bit better. But, you know, I still don't necessarily love the old school approach. Like, how's Brandon Marsh supposed to get any better at hitting lefties if he just doesn't hit them?
Yeah, and that's the thing. See, approaching Brandon Marsh as though he's a platoon player.
Yeah, like that's what's happening. He's like approaching him like he's a platoon player is just giving up half. Like you're already, you know, conceding defeat halfway. Yeah. You know, you're already saying that, all right, well, I don't think this is going to happen. So it's I don't like it.
Yeah, I think everyone can see what Brandon Marsh has been able to do this year, and it just makes you want to see him in the lineup every day. And this was one of those cases. But again, you can't criticize it without pointing out that Rob Thompson's doing this stuff, or in this case, made that decision because the numbers were there and the numbers supported him. As frustrating as it can be to see Pache, whose specialties are defense and speed, but certainly not hitting, in the lineup. Even though, hey, he hits lefties. He does. Yeah.
Every other part of him I find slightly annoying right now, though. Every single other part of him I find frustrating. I did not enjoy watching him play that much.
Well, as I mentioned in Game 3, the Trey Turner stolen base streak ended at 41. Matt Gelb said the Phillies were trying to run a play that they'd tried in the postseason. The Reds were onto it and through a kind of a violent collision that Trey Turner was tagged out at third base. Though Alec Boehm did have a four-hit day, knocking in two runs in Game 3. Johan Rojas had a hit, an RBI, and a stolen base. Since a three-hit game on April 8th, Johan Rojas is hitting .348 with an .823 OPS. He has a mere 10% strikeout percentage, the lowest on the Phillies other than Whit Merrifield, who I don't think has nearly as many plate appearances as Rojas. Spencer Turnbull, in what is considered his last start for the time being, he was not bad. He gave up a homer to Will Benson of the Reds, who was in the middle of a career-worst 0-for-18 slump when he hit that. Turnbull returned to the dugout, slamming his glove, clearly frustrated about the pitch that turned into a bunch of runs for the Reds. Liz, are you disappointed to see Spencer Turnbull headed to the bullpen with the return of Taijuan Walker during this series in San Diego?
I don't think disappointed is the right word. I think it's probably the right time. How much? He's not going to continue on like that forever. Do you want him to do that? Do you want him to regress hard in a start? Or, a garbage time inning that they give him to, just keep pitching? Like, I think I'm all right with him being moved to the bullpen because he can be moved back. And I do think that over time, he'll still be effective. But Taijuan Walker, I think, deserves a shot.
I mean, I think you have to at least move Turnbull to give Walker the chance. I think he's the guy
exactly.
You move. And you got to at least see what you got in Taijuan Walker. I can't say my hopes are particularly high.
No.
Though reports out of his rehab starts have been solid. But that velocity just hasn't climbed back to where it was. And this is a guy who was already not... I think was struggling before this last year. We saw him have some issues, so I will certainly allow for he's going to get a couple of starts, I would imagine. It's not like he's going to come out from returning from injury and give one start to the Phillies and they make a decision based on that. They're gonna see what he's got. They're gonna put him on the mound. It's going to happen. Prepare yourself is what I'm saying. And Turnbull has to be ready to come in because he's not just Taijuan Walker's backup. He is the entire pitching staff's backup. He's the sixth man of this rotation. Mm-hmm. So you got to keep him fresh. People were citing this, he hasn't thrown many innings, certainly not a full season's worth of starts in quite some time. So to keep him ready to go when you need him, you do have to move him to the bullpen. I think people were thinking in terms of just, it's Spencer Turnbull or Taijuan Walker. But again, that's not really the case. Turnbull's got to be ready to do long relief if the Phillies need it, which they did during Christopher Sanchez's start. Hopefully that's not a very frequent occurrence. We've seen this team put together a lot of deep starts lately, but it's going to happen. And like I said, you never know when you're going to need a healthy arm to make a start, a guy who can go 6-7 innings, which Turnbull has proven he can. You just don't want to push him too hard by having him do that every fifth day for the first few months of the season. I saw some people trying to make the argument that you got to go with the hot hand. He may eventually flame out, but you got to just push him till he reaches that point. You're like, okay, I don't know about that. That seems like a particularly aggro approach to pitching staff management, and needlessly so, especially when you know that it's a long season and your arms are going to get eaten up whether they're out there, pushing it or not. It's just that long of a season. It's that much of a slog. So I think it's definitely the best move to get Turnbull in the bullpen, get him a little bit more rest so that he can be available for any relief needs you have and also any starting needs you have moving forward. But speaking of relief... Oh boy. That game three was a bit of a mess. You had Gregory Soto load the bases in the seventh. He gave up a sack fly. Jose Alvarado gave up a single to Elly De La Cruz, who then stole second and third and came in to score on a sack fly. That was irritating. That was, I hate when that, I love when, like, obviously Phillies are able to do that. It's so aggressive. It's so like, hey, look, I know I can beat you to the bag anytime I want. Watch me go. I love it. I feel like we've seen guys do that. But when it happens to you, it's just, it's the other side of that. And at that point in the game, it was like, boy, we are just letting them get away with it here. But of course, you really can't talk about the relief implosions without, unfortunately, talking about Sir Anthony Dominguez. An absolute disaster in the sixth inning of Game 3. His slider is still moving laterally, but not dipping vertically out of the way of bats.
And that is not good.
And when the bats find it, they are not being kind. Guys are just hammering it, which is bad because he throws that slider over a quarter of the time, as noted by Alex Coffey. So now he's got a pitch he relies on that has been blasted out of the stadium three times already this season. And again, Alex Coffey of the Inquirer writes that he will likely see some lower leverage situations in the immediate future to build his confidence back up. So, Liz, what's the move with Sir Anthony here? Fans, naturally, they want to dump him. They want to send him to Allentown. Rob Thompson says they're going to work with him on getting that slider to slide right so that he can be an effective member of the Phillies bullpen again. Which idea has more appeal to you now, or is there some sort of third idea that exists between the extremes?
I mean, you want to, if they believe in him, and so that's good, right? That's a good thing. And yes, lower leverage innings are good, but I'm sort of like looking at the bullpen, and you know, it's not like April is a, you know, we can't overreact too much to stuff in April, but you need to keep an eye on some of these guys, like Sir Anthony. And a gentleman by the name of Gregory Soto, whose ERA is 8.22 right now.
Yeah, Soto gave us the good version of a Gregory Soto appearance, I believe in game one, where it was just a real nice 1-2-3 inning. Mm-hmm. And you were like, all right, this is great. But then we did see that Gregory Soto, who makes everybody nervous, pop out in game three, which the Phillies did lose 7-4. Thanks in large part to that bullpen implosion. But again, this factors into the many reasons Rob Thompson was catching a lot of heat after that game. There was the righty-heavy lineup that didn't have the names in it people wanted to see. There was going to the bullpen after only 89 pitches from Spencer Turnbull, which did feel premature. There was not getting anyone warmed up while Sir Anthony was just languishing out there and facing six batters when, boy, it felt like after the first one, maybe he shouldn't have even faced one batter. And then there was not pinch hitting for Bryson Stott for Edmundo Sosa in the seventh with second and third and one out, down with the Phillies down 5-4. There are other issues you could probably pull up that you could blame Rob Thompson for. Was there a particular moment you felt, or did you feel any particular frustration with Rob Thompson? I feel like we've been pretty calm and rational about the calls for Rob Thompson. You know, in the most extreme cases, people saying, oh, he should be fired, which is just, you know, it still sounds like lunacy. But I feel like after this game, game three, this was really the first time where I felt like, you know, I've seen him make decisions that I disagreed with in the past. I've seen him do things and operate and use certain approaches that I was just like, oh, boy, here we go. Like we're talking about with matchups and bullpen management. Occasionally you're like, oh, why did he do that? Oh, I don't like that. Or why is he starting him or whatever? Is that a Joe Girardi type move? But this was the first game where you could so easily stack so many critiques against Rob Thompson on top of each other. And that was something I felt was kind of new for me, at least.
Yeah, that's the concerning part. You know, every manager is going to have one thing in one game that doesn't go their way that they could have probably prevented with a different move. But you never know. You know, and a lot of those things are defendable. But when you get a stack like that in one game and it's part of a pattern of letting opportunities slip by, you know, you get concerned. I'm not even going to say concerned is even too much of a word. Like, that's even too strong. You know, if I could raise one of my eyebrows, which I can't, despite having like extraordinarily strong forehead muscles, I cannot individually operate my eyebrows.
Interesting. I can do both. So let me tell you, life's pretty good.
What was I talking about? Crap.
You managed to pivot from Rob Thompson critiques to I can't raise either of my eyebrows individually.
Okay, no, I was trying to figure out a lesser word than concern. If I could raise one of my eyebrows, one of them would be raised right now. Like about this decision. Like, I'm going to note this in my little notebook of things that I'm keeping track of, and you know, we'll see what happens.
Oh, do you have a Phillies complaint diary too?
Yes, it is a bag that I scream into every day.
Yeah, don't open that bag. You don't know what's going to come out. Well, fortunately, the Phillies salvaged the city's sanity, which was already tenuous given that the Sixers are embroiled in a quite touchy playoff series at the moment. But in game four, we got vintage Zach Wheeler. Four out of the six innings that the Phillies ace pitched in game four against the Reds were 1-2-3 innings efficiency. He allowed one hit, four walks, eight strikeouts, a bunch of deep counts, which was probably why he only went six, which starting to sound like not that long of a start for Phillies starters.
Yeah.
That was a season high in walks with four. Mm-hmm. You're going to see that pointed out. He's allowed multiple walks in actually all three of his most recent starts, after having only two in his first three starts combined. So despite the walks, Wheeler played the role of the stopper for the Phillies' first kind of skid of the season. Not the first skid since that hot streak, let's say. And they still haven't lost three games in a row. That's the beauty of a good rotation. You can't get beat too many times when every starter is giving you a good chance to win. Alex Coffey writes that the starting rotation has a 2.12 ERA over 26 games. With an MLB best 184 batting average against. Liz, before the season, if I had told you, yeah, Phillies rotation by the end of April, they're going to have an ERA collectively under 250. And like they will be hit the least. Like they will allow opponents to generate the least amount of offense by the end of the season's first month. This would have surprised you, met your expectations, exceeded your expectations.
You said the least amount of offense, you said?
Yeah, yes.
That would not have surprised me. Weirdly, despite all of the stuff we've seen, like the Phillies did not inspire a lot of offensive confidence going into the early part of the season. We've seen little flashes, but like that wouldn't surprise me. Like that they've been terrible at offense. I mean that they're.
Oh, no, I'm saying the other teams facing the Phillies rotation.
I completely misunderstood.
184 batting average against.
That it's that low, and that it's been contributed to by so many.
Yeah,
it wasn't just like Zach Wheeler throwing like a perfect game or something, and like
right,
you know, it's everyone's contributing to keeping it that low.
It's the full season too. Like you can throw the argument in that they faced those two terrible teams for six games, but that's only part of the season. Like that, these numbers are reflective of their production as a whole. From the beginning, back in March, like it's more than just they faced some bad teams. No, they faced the teams they were scheduled to face, and the results have been better. I think better than expected. I don't think anyone was expecting this rotation to be among the worst in the league, or even average. I think it was fair to say that like they could be projected to be a top 10 rotation in all of baseball, but that they're looking this dominant top to bottom with Christopher Sanchez's kind of brief start in this series being an outlier recently. I think that is a pleasant surprise. You know, it's not like, oh my God, this is totally unexpected. It's just more like, wow, I did not.
Holy crap.
Yeah, this is at a level I did not expect to. And honestly, thank goodness, because this team needs a strength it can rely on with some kind of consistency. That is an aspect that it does not have from its bullpen at the moment, from its lineup at the moment. So to be able to rely on this kind of like strong backbone of starting pitching, like I said, it's kept them in every game. You know, even games they've lost, that it has kept them in every game and given them a chance to win. So that's something that I think is really important.
Yes. Like yesterday for me felt like the perfect opportunity for the Phillies to blow it somewhere. Because Zach Wheeler was on the mound and he had been doing well, But he also threw 103 pitches in six innings, which is, you know, or 103 pitches in six innings, which is, I think, is most in the shortest number of innings. So he loaded the bases at one point. I thought, this game is out of control. Not that I had no faith in Wheeler, but I was just like, how is he going to get out of this? and all of a sudden, just like it was over. And I'm like, all right. And then after that, I'm like, well, this is just a perfect opportunity for the bullpen to blow it for him after he, you know, had managed to, you know, pull his butt out of the fire. And, you know, they didn't. You know, it felt like that was a game that they could have lost just as much of the other games. They didn't snatch anything away, but I feel like they were a stopper, and it wasn't just Wheeler.
Well, it's telling that both of the Phillies' victories in this series were shutouts.
Yes.
Because, again, it tells you that they were able to lean on their starting pitching and then just, you know, score when they found opportunities to do so, which are always feels like less often than they should. But in this game, we got a Bryson Stott triple that knocked in a run in the third inning, and that was followed not too long after by a Bryce Harper home run as he returned from the paternity list. That was able to give them a 4-run lead in the third. They tacked on another run in the sixth, and that was all they needed. In a Zach Wheeler start, that was all they needed, 5 runs. Kyle Schwarber had a sack fly. You know, they were able to generate the offense they needed, and, you know, hey, win's a win. You know, I saw nothing to truly complain about after that game, and I was pleased that they were able to split that series. You know, obviously it would have been nice to win one of those games and not, you know, avoid the bullpen implosions that led to their losses, but hey, you know, they're leaving Cincinnati and heading out west without having lost that series. I think that's important. As far as the bullpen goes, it isn't a complete disaster. Orion Kerkering, Jeff Hoffman, and Matt Strom combined over the last 4 games to allow no earned runs in this series, which is even better when I tell you that Kerkering and Hoffman were numbers 1 and 2 in usage over these last 4 games as far as the bullpen goes. Kerkering threw 2 2/3 innings of relief. Hoffman got 2 1/3. Matt Strom got 1 1/3. Hoffman struck out 5 of the 8 batters he faced and gave up 0 hard contact per Fangraphs. Neither did Kerkering. So they're putting the ball in the right place where the Reds could not reach it and certainly couldn't hit it hard. As I said, Gregory Soto did struggle. It wasn't all sunshine and rainbows, as you might have seen. He gave them a clean inning on 11 pitches and 2 strikeouts in Game 1, but gave up a couple of hits and a walk as part of that Game 3 disaster. Sir Anthony obviously had a bad series, got hung out to dry by his manager a bit. Junior Marte saw 10 batters, gave up hits to 4 of them, including a home run. No Phillies reliever gave up more hits in this series than Junior Marte. Ricardo Pinto, who is still here, served up a homer in a brief appearance to Ellie De La Cruz of the Reds in Game 2. And even Jose Alvarado couldn't escape clean, dropping in for an inning of work in this series and giving up a walk, a hit, and a run. Felt like Game 3 fell off the rails when Sanchez's start went a little poorly, and after that, the Phillies just didn't have much to lean on outside of Alec Bohm's bat. Speaking of which, let's get to the offense. Over the past 10 days, Alex Coffey of the Inquirer notes, the Phillies have been a top 5 team in all of Major League Baseball in batting average, on base percentage, and slugging. Bryce Harper returns, homers for the second time immediately after returning from paternity leave in Game 4. Something about being a dad, Liz, makes that man hit a baseball with the violence of a lightning strike. It's the second time he's done that, Matt Gelb noted, after returning from paternity leave. Harper's homer was the only one of the series for the Phillies, other than the one that his replacement, Cody Clemens, hit in Game 1. Is it surprising to hear that in a 4-game series, the Phillies hit 2 home runs and are still a top 5 team in slugging percentage over the past 10 days, Liz?
It was a little bit surprising. You know, they've won 8 of their last 10, but they've, you know, I guess it wasn't surprised. I don't know. I was kind of surprised to see it was like not good, but at the same time, I get it, because the amount that I've been frustrated at them this season when they just aren't hitting for any reason is a lot. Like, because it feels at the same time like they are very good, but also like they're a team of extremes right now. It's like the hitting is really great and the pitching is awesome, or one of those is great and the other is really awful.
It's like they struggle and then you get frustrated with the struggling, and then like a 3 days later somebody's like, well, did you know that the Phillies have the highest ISO, isolated power in all of baseball? And you're like, how
exactly
is that possible? What are you talking
not
about?
Not possible.
Or they're just, everyone's like, oh, they're getting off to such a sluggish start. And then they're like, well, this is the best start the Phillies have had since 2019. And you're like, what are you
like,
talking
about? Are you serious? I saw that. I'm like, no, it's not.
Yeah.
How bad have they? Oh, they've been bad. Okay. All right.
And then you look at the standings and then, you know, they're like a half a game behind the Braves or something. And like for a while, they have about the same win total. They might have like one fewer at this point. And you're like, wait, no, how can that be? Yeah. Braves are 17-6. The Phillies are 16-10. Obviously, there's some disparity there, but
yeah,
it's
played
a
few more games.
Yeah. And it's a lot closer than, you know, the vibes would have had you feel after the first two series this season. So I think everyone's kind of stuck in that first gear. I'm guilty of it too.
Oh yeah.
But then, you know, somebody like I said, Alex Coffey notes, this offense has been top five in its slash line for the past 10 days, which is, you know, a measurement that is very indicative of it being early in the season, but still that's not nothing. And speaking of not nothing, Alec Bohm had 9 hits in this series. 9.
He is one of two people hitting over 300 for the Phillies right now.
For these 4 games, he hit .563.
Like, what is that?
He hit 5 doubles in 4 games.
That he was, you could not keep him off base. You could not keep him off the base paths, and that is so encouraging.
Yeah. I mean, he is right now, he is the engine for this offense, which, you know, given who's in this offense, might not be your first guess, but hey, it's Alec Bohm, man. He has turned into a better than average hitter and a key contributor for this offense. Rob Thompson bats him where he bats him because he wants people on base when Alec Bohm is at the plate. Because, you know, chances are right now, he's just going to double him in.
Yep.
Bryson Stott in limited playing time. These 4 games, went 2-for-4 yesterday with a triple and 2 RBI. Trey Turner kept hitting at a steady pace. Johan Rojas had that triple in game 1. JT Realmuto had a couple of doubles in this series. I saw this note from Seamus Clancy over at Philly Voice. Brandon Marsh's .827 OPS on the 2024 season is currently higher than that of Aaron Judge, Matt Olson, Freddie Freeman, Cody Bellinger, Corey Seager, Jose Ramirez, Yordan Alvarez, and others.
And many, many others. Holy cow.
Speaking of numbers that get you in the lineup, that one should probably be of note. Kyle Schwarber struck out 9 times in 15 at-bats versus
start.
The Cincinnati Reds.
Feels like he's having a great start and it's going well. Anytime they write about that, it definitely keeps happening.
It looked like he was on the right track there for a beginning of the season that was, you know, not reflective of his reputation, which, as we know, he is somebody whose reputation is that he doesn't start hitting until June. He was hitting, you know, he was homering, hitting a lot of laser singles, but this series, these 4 games in Cincinnati, were not kind to him. He walked dejectedly back to the dugout quite a few times, but he did also walk 3 times, so he was able to keep that aspect of his offensive output intact. And of course, we gotta mention it, even though there is no solution or any kind of satisfying conclusion in play as of yet to this particular issue, but Elizabeth, Nick Castellanos went 3-for-17 against the Reds. He is hitting .177 with a .431 OPS. He still has just the 1 extra base hit on the season. On Billy Penn last week, I wrote that maybe put him in a bouncy castle with Brandon Marsh, because at least one of them would be having the time of their lives. I don't have a lot of answers outside of that realm about Nick Castellanos at this point. And honestly, Liz, I'm not sure he does either.
Yeah, I don't think so at all. He doesn't. I mean, the only thing he could do is what every other baseball player does, which is keep going. And it sucks that it's that, and it feels worse than it is. And because it's bad. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. It's bad, but it feels a lot worse than it is right now, because this is all we have of him for the season. This is all we've seen. So it will get better. It has to.
Right. I mean, an optimist take here is that you could see, like, oh, Nick Castellanos had a solid 2024. He got off to a bad start in April, but, like, rebounded. You know, we're not past the point of no return. It's just more that you don't know when that turnaround that is still theoretical could happen.
And that's the concerning part, because the turnaround is theoretical until it happens.
Right. For now, he is just not the guy you want to see come up in a key situation. I wish if there was an equivalent to saying, well, we're like with Sir Anthony, we're just going to put him in low leverage situations to build his confidence back up. Unfortunately, that's not how offense works in baseball. So he's going to come up in key situations. And right now, he is just not the guy you want to see in those situations. And I know calls are for him to maybe take a game off, and I certainly see there could be benefits to that, but what do you really gain from that? Like you're saying, there's only one way for him to start hitting, and that's for him to be in the game. I can see, like, okay, get his mind off things for a night or two, let him, like, take some time, but that's not a guaranteed fix, and maybe it disrupts any kind of rhythm he thinks he's building too. So at this point, why not? But also, he's not going to get better sitting on the bench, I guess. You know, so it's a frustrating circumstance where a veteran hitter who you know can hit just isn't. Mm-hmm. And, you know, hopefully we see a turnaround. You know, we hoped we'd see it in Cincinnati. We didn't. Hopefully we see it in San Diego.
I mean, it took a long time for Rob Thompson to get to the point where he's like, yes, my God, Trey, please take a game off. You have to. That was way late in the season before they were like, this is now starting to, like, actually worm its way into your brain, we fear, permanently. And that's when things did end up turning around for him. But, like, it's way too early in the season for them to be discussing take a game off. Like, no, right now, this early, the only solution is to work. That's it. And it sucks because we're watching him get in that work in games that count. But that's how baseball is. Not everyone's going to be hitting well at the same time. And the only person who's going to get himself out of it is Nick Castellanos.
Yep. And we'll see. Like I said, the Phillies are now off to the West Coast to try and see if the issues they have on the East Coast still happen on the West. My guess? Yes, they will.
Probably.
You're going to get Aaron Nola and Joe Musgrove in game one tonight, starting at 9:40 for the late night crowd. Ranger Suarez and Dylan Cease in game two. That's another good matchup. And then finally, the return of Taiwan Walker taking on Michael King in the Sunday matinee. Here's a fun note. We just talked about Bryce Harper returning from paternity leave and hitting a home run. Manny Machado is also returning from being a first-time dad. His wife and him just both had their first child. And I got to say, hopefully he's not like Harper, that he does not come back with a bunch of new dad strength, but I don't know.
There's only one Bryce Harper.
Yeah, Bryce Harper's the only one I want to see coming to the plate with dad strength. So
I want him to be the only person in Major League Baseball history to do that. It's such a niche thing, but, like, it's such an awesome random stat. Bryce Harper is the only player to, you know, hit home runs both times he returned from the paternity list.
And hopefully the Phillies starting pitching maintains its strengths and the offense continues the momentum it's built despite its flaws. So we'll see what happens, but the Phillies are heading out west to San Diego for the weekend. And I'm now joined by Mitch Rupert, former baseball writer for the Williamsport Sun-Gazette and Phillies minor league connoisseur, contributor to PhilliesMinorThoughts.com. Mitch, how are you?
I'm doing great, man. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Everybody was talking on Wednesday about Gabriel Rincones Jr.'s home run in Reading out of First Energy Stadium. Just a powerhouse showcase. I think it probably got him on a couple more people's radar, which is generally the uphill battle a prospect is fighting as far as, like, familiarity goes with fans who maybe aren't tapped into the Phillies minor league system. You, of course, are someone whose perspective is always appreciated on these matters. You recently wrote a post for PhilliesMinorThoughts.com about Scott Kingery and his success in the Phillies minor league system, and also just how viewing that doesn't have to mean anything. It can just be enjoyment. And I want to get to that in a little bit. But first of all, It was being framed when Rincones, a 23-year-old first base prospect for the Phillies playing in Reading this year, hit a home run out of First Energy Stadium and across Route 61. Could you please contextualize that for people? Because I'm not sure they understand how much of a feat this was.
No, and I think I even referenced when somebody had sent me the picture of they found the ball across Route 61 and they took a picture of it. And I even said, anybody who's been to Reading, been to First Energy Stadium or Park or whatever it's called now, they know what kind of shot this was. But it was hard to put it into context because the camera work on it was so bad. Like all we had was the hit. Like we didn't have following the ball. Now the Reading Fightin' Phils, they put out other video the next day and you can see the ball go behind the new events center in right center field, if you look real close, and bounce onto Route 61. So that is not a staged photo, but this is one of the guys in the system that has this holy crap raw power that you see every once in a while. And just seeing him put bat to ball on a swing like this, understanding what he's capable of now. I think somebody posted on Twitter, and I feel bad I don't have names right now, but they did like a Google Maps version, 506 feet from home plate to where the ball landed. Now that's not all on the fly, but that's a poke. I don't care who you are. I don't care if you're Bryce Harper. I don't care if you're me. That's a poke. and trying to put it into context is really just about saying, look what this kid's capable of. You know, he may not be the best pure hitter and he's not the best pure hitter, but he's hitting pretty well. There's a lot to like about Gabriel Rincones Jr. There's a lot to be concerned about. I think he is kind of still a high risk prospect, but this is what he's capable of. And if you see something like this consistently, then it's time to start thinking, okay, maybe we got something here.
I personally like getting 500 plus foot messages from the minors. I feel like it's a good way to really get yourself known, get yourself some attention. And like you said, it's a great way to show off what you're capable of. And I was familiar with Rincones. He was part of the contingent that went out to the Arizona Fall League this past autumn and actually participated in the home run derby out there. He did not win, but he was a participant. Originally drafted by the Padres, he chose to go to Florida Atlantic instead. The Phils took him in the third round of the 2022 amateur draft after he hit .346 with an 1109 OPS for Florida Atlantic and 19 home runs. He won Conference USA Newcomer of the Year after he had arrived there. He is among the exit velocity leaders on the college circuit when the Phillies drafted him. He was regularly hitting the ball in the 110s. And so he can hit the ball hard, like you're saying. And it doesn't hurt that he's 6'4", 225 pounds. So like you said, all the scouting reports tell you the same thing. Plus power, a lot more versus righties than lefties. Outfielder that seems like he's bound for more of a first base DH role. Below average defense and speed. And hit 15 home runs in 2023, mostly at high A Jersey Shore for the Phillies. One thing I wanted to ask was prospect lists, depending on the outlet, really vary on Rincones. And I know that as a guy who played mostly in high A last year, has only just started playing at double A, you know, he's not close to the major league. So I feel like the evaluations are a little broader at this stage. But I saw him placed anywhere from a top, like the sixth best prospect in the Philly system to the 21st ranked prospect in the Philly system, which seemed like a wider berth than a lot of guys get. Do you think that evaluators aren't sure what to make of a guy like Rincones yet because of how differently they have ranked him depending on the outlet?
I think it's two things. I think it's that, which you say, and we're still not quite sure because he was a decent player, a good player last year through his time in Jersey Shore, but he took off in the Arizona Fall League. And that's it's a really small sample size. So you don't know what part of that is real versus what you saw over the course of a full regular season. The other part of that is it all depends on what you value as an evaluator. Are you looking for a major league ready guy? He's not a major league ready guy. So somebody who's looking for major league ready kind of prospects maybe doesn't value him as much. Are you a potential guy? Like if you're looking for somebody who's got all world potential and one really loud tool, maybe two, then this is a guy that's going to pique your interest quite a bit. So I think those are the two things that kind of factor into it. And that's why you see lists that vary so much. I mean, it's easy to say Andrew Painter or Aiden Miller or Justin Crawford's one of the top prospects in the system. We see it. It's harder when guys don't have the full arsenal of weapons that those three might have. And there's some really loud tools here that Gabriel Rincones Jr. has. And obviously from what we saw the other day, but there's, we have to see how the other things fit into that. He stole 40 some odd bases last year, but he's not a really fast guy, you know? So how does that factor in? He's hitting 300, I think in a really small sample size this year. He hit 290, in the fall league, but he's not a hit tool guy. So it's trying to put all of this stuff into context, and everybody's got different opinions about the context around what you see in any given player. So it's really hard to rank them. That's and especially a guy who you know has faults like Gabriel Rincones does. He swings and misses a lot, but he also walks a lot, you know, so there's an eye there. He just swings and misses. So it's hard to rank a guy like this because you don't know what he is. You can only guess.
What is your, and perhaps we could piece this together based on everything you've been saying, but your personal take as a minor league connoisseur on Gabriel Rincones Jr.? I know a lot of evaluators will be really careful. They'll say like, well, you know, it's very early. We are obviously making that pretty clear. Like it is still pretty early in this 23-year-old's career. He is not somebody that's going to sniff the major leagues this year. He actually went on the 7-day injured list not too long after hitting that home run that got him in the headlines. But like you said, he was hitting 300. But from a personal stance, your perspective as somebody who watches and enjoys a lot of minor league baseball, Gabriel Rincones, or even just a guy who profiles like him comes along, what's your personal take as far as like out thinking ahead to the future, which is, you know, how most fans are going to approach looking at a guy like this?
So going back to my days of covering the crosscutters, my thought process was always show me one thing that is a major league caliber tool. And if you show me one thing that's a major league caliber tool, you got an opportunity to play in the big leagues. And we obviously know he's got the major league caliber power like that. That is, that will play on that level. I don't care if you're playing in the Polo Grounds or if you're playing at Great American Ballpark, that power plays in the big leagues. You know, now it's going to be about whether or not those things filter around and make him a more complete player. So my thought process is always wait and see. I'm not a hot take guy. I don't like to say this guy's definitely an all-star, this guy's definitely a big leaguer, or this guy's a bust, he's got no shot. I'm a wait and see guy. He's played 133 games in the minor leagues since being drafted. He didn't play his draft year. You know, he's played 13 games this year. We don't know what he is. I can dream that if he is this guy, if he is a 300, 400, 600 slash guy, okay, that's really, really good. But is it sustainable in the big leagues? I don't know. So the answer to your question, Justin, is I don't know. Like I honestly just don't know what he is. I know he's fun as hell to watch. And every time he has an at bat, I'm probably going to tune in from whatever other game I'm watching to see what happens. But that's the same with Baron Radcliffe. When Rickson Wingrove was in still in the system, I was looking for what he does. Going back to Jalen Ortiz, you know, those are guys that you don't flip the channel when they come up to hit. So I have no idea what he's going to be. I have no idea what he is, but he's on the radar, and that's all you can kind of hope for. Not everybody's going to be a future all-star. Not everybody's going to be a future Hall of Famer. Not everybody's a bust. Sometimes you just got to be on the radar and see what happens. And that's where I am. I'm a pretty patient guy.
I feel like when a lot of amateur evaluators, by which I mean people who don't evaluate often, take a look at the minors, they often classify prospects based on what you just said. Either this guy's a stud who has a future in the majors, or he's a bust. But I feel like most prospects exist in that space in between, where they're trying to be one and trying not to be the other, and nobody really knows the end of the story yet because they were drafted because of raw talent. It's about how that raw talent kind of gets whittled away or formed or molded by whoever they're interacting with and being coached by and playing with in the minors. Like that's the challenge. I mean, that's the unique challenge of baseball specifically, because these guys get drafted and then it's, you know, maybe 3, 4, 5 years before they get to the majors. They're not ready to contribute right away. But still, seeing raw power like the kind Rincones put on display, he keeps hitting home runs like that, he's going to get a lot of people thinking about the future and, as you put it, dreaming about the future, I think, in a hurry. I know my first thought when I saw that home run was, this is not fair, but it's just the first thing I thought of. A Dick Allen-esque 520-foot shot over the Coca-Cola sign at Connie Mack Stadium, something I wasn't even alive for by a large margin. But still, like, hearing stories about that and just you find out there's a guy like that in the minor leagues, it can get people talking. It can get people pretty excited.
Sure, and you should be. Like, it's okay to be excited about these guys. What I don't like is when we slap labels on these guys. You know, when Johan Rojas first broke out in the minor leagues, and it may have very well been the year that he was in Williamsport, and I just started to go, who in the world is this guy and why have I never heard of him? And people wanted to say, well, he's the Phillies Ronald Acuña. No, he's not.
Oh,
you
boy.
Know, nobody is anybody's Ronald Acuña.
Yeah, no pressure.
Because Ronald Acuña is Ronald Acuña. Everybody else is everybody else. Like, he's not that. And we want to slap labels on these people. And it does two things. Like, it drives those expectations so high that they can't possibly live up to them. Or it drives expectations so low that as a prospect, you can't dig out of that in the perception of people, whether you get to the big leagues or not, you know, and that's what I hate about it, because like you said, everybody lives for the most part in the middle there somewhere, and you look for something that looks like big league talent and hope that it kind of flourishes. I mean, here's, be excited about Gabriel Rincones. Like I said, he's played 133 games in the minors. He's at Double A. Like, he was drafted less than 2 years ago. He's already in Double A. He's got a shot. He's not major league ready, but he's got a shot. And I think there's a chance there to be an impact player. It's just, to what level of that impact is it going to be? You know, and I think it's okay. And this is my own personal, I think it's okay to say, I don't know yet. And I wish more people would say, I don't know yet, but it's fun to watch, and I'm going to keep watching it.
Yeah, this feels like it qualifies in the same topic as you recently wrote about on Philly's Minor Thoughts about Scott Kingery, who was also putting up some really solid numbers at Lehigh Valley. And this is obviously a guy a lot of Phillies fans are familiar with. We all know he got that 6-year extension before ever playing in the major leagues. It was a big Matt Klintak deal one spring. And, you know, for a variety of reasons, you can blame a lot of different people, it just never really clicked. He never became the player that he was in a lot of ways being unfairly forced into becoming. But there he is in the last year of his deal, still playing his heart out at AAA and putting up great numbers. And you wrote a piece talking about how, you know, you can just enjoy this as what it is. You don't have to think about all the backstory I just gave. You don't have to think about what it could mean for the future. You don't have to think, well, he's hitting really well, why don't we just swap out Whit Merrifield for Scott Kingery? And there's no other details to even consider. Just do that. There's just some enjoyment to get out of watching a good baseball player play good baseball. And it feels like Gabriel Rincones Jr. hitting a home run like this qualifies for that sort of thing, especially as early in his development as he is.
Exactly. And there is nothing that will blow up my mentions more than posting a Scott Kingery highlight. And I don't even have to put it an opinion on it. Like, I don't even have to say, oh, he's ready to come back. You know, I don't have to say that. I can just say Scott Kingery hit a 3-run home run tonight and my mentions are done. It is either, well, send Castellanos down, send Merrifield down, DFA somebody, because this guy needs to be in the lineup. Or on the flip side of that, it's screw this guy. What's he ever done for us? He's nothing but a bust. He's 30 years old. Get rid of him. And it's okay to watch good people make good baseball plays and enjoy it. Like, it is okay. Is it fun? Maybe it's not as much fun as, you know, having pitchforks and tiki torches and running around and trying to get people to believe the same thing you do. Maybe it's not as fun.
That is fun. But I will say
it is.
That is.
But I mean, here's the thing, Justin. I was like, look at what this kid has been through. And I call him a kid, and he's 30 years old, but he still feels like a kid. Like, yeah. He has done nothing, but everything that has been asked of him by the organization, oftentimes to his own detriment. And the only thing he's ever said is, yes, sir, I'll do whatever you need me to do. And then he's gone out and he's worked and he's played as hard as he can. He's been through injuries the last couple years. He had the COVID thing, which knocked him on his butt, and it clearly affected him a number of years ago for quite a long time. I think I read he had a shoulder thing last year that was bothering him. He's finally healthy. So here's a guy who's done everything to his own detriment that has been asked of him, and he's finally having some success. It's okay to say, good for you, man. Go out and continue to have success. Maybe you're never going to play for the Phillies again, but maybe you can find somewhere else. Maybe somebody takes a shot on him and he gets the opportunity to show what kind of player he can be at the big league level. And maybe it never works out for him. Maybe he's never a big league regular. Maybe he's a bench guy. Maybe he never gets back. Who cares? As long as he's having fun, as long as he's enjoying himself, as long as he's being successful, good for him, man. Because I don't know that there's anybody who really deserves it more than Scott Kingery.
Well, I completely agree that sometimes you can just watch baseball and enjoy it for what's in front of you, and enjoy it simply in the present without thinking about the past or the future and how it fits in. There's definitely some enjoyment to be gleaned there, and the minor leagues is a great place to find it. And as far as Gabriel Rincones Jr., I did want to ask, is it true that he lived in Scotland for 6 years, so he's technically eligible to play for Great Britain in the 2026 World Baseball Classic? Do you know that?
I have never heard that, but that would be awesome if it was. I mean, Rincones doesn't sound like a Scottish name to me, so there's a story there that I would like to hear.
Yeah, I just saw that before we jumped on. I saw somebody talking about that. I was like, I have no idea if that's true, but if Mitch can confirm that, then it's true. So, you know, unverified, but just something I saw out there about a prospect who's heating up in Reading. And Reading is famously a home run friendly ballpark, but hey, so is Citizens Bank Park. And while there's plenty of enjoyment to get from watching a minor league prospect succeed, it is also fun to dream about any potential future where Gabriel Rincones Jr. is coming up and hitting home runs out of Citizens Bank Park into the Delaware. So a lot of fun, big home run this week. Keep an eye on Gabriel Rincones Jr. when he comes back from the injured list. And honestly, if you haven't been to Reading, if you haven't been to First Energy Stadium, it's one of the best minor league parks in baseball. Make some time, get out there and see what the Reading Fightins are capable of doing this year. Mitch, thank you so much for joining us here on Hittin' Season.
Justin, great to talk to you, man. Appreciate it.
That'll do it for this episode. Don't forget to check out billypenn.com/hittinseason to get all the new episodes of Hittin' Season. And for extra Phillies content, head on over to the Patreon at patreon.com/hittinseason. For my co-host, Liz Rocher of Yahoo Sports, and my guest, Mitch Rupert, former baseball writer for the Williamsport Sun Gazette and a contributor to philliesminorthoughts.com. Thank you for listening. And from WHYY and Billy Penn, this has been Hittin' Season.